The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
This is Paul, and I'll be reading an article from the National Geographic magazine entitled, "Was Wally Pitcher a Real Person?" by Aaron Blackmore. During the darkest days of the American Revolution, women followed their husbands into war, aiding American troops with much-needed water and medical care, and bravely fighting alongside male soldiers during key battles. In American folklore, a woman nicknamed, quote, "Molly Pitcher," end quote, typified the grit and courage of these women who selflessly provided comfort to soldiers on the battlefield. Historians now believe Molly Pitcher is a historical myth, a composite folk figure who embodied the wartime experiences of multiple real-life women. Female volunteers played an important role on Revolutionary War battlefields, even though they were barred from military service and largely unrecognized for their efforts. Here's what to know about the legend of Molly Pitcher and the real-life women she represents. The origins of Molly Pitcher. Historians largely agree there was no single woman named Molly Pitcher, and no known contemporaneous account of a woman active in Revolutionary War battles cites that name. But as historian Emily Lewis Butterfield notes, anecdotes began circulating about such a figure during the 1830s. As Americans told and retold stories about the nation's founding. The stories that emerged about Molly took two main forms. In one, battlefield soldiers called Molly Pitcher as they asked for water to slake their thirst and help swab down their artillery. Molly was a common nickname for even more common than Mary. In another, a woman named Mary showed bravery in battle, often the 1778 Battle of Monmouth. Since the Molly Pitcher name only emerged in accounts of the war long after its end and does not appear in any known battlefield documentation from the war itself, historians can't pinpoint a single incident or person who may have inspired the legend. But though it is unclear whether the Molly Pitcher legend was based on a specific woman or a battle cry, what is almost certain is that Molly Pitcher stories were inspired by real-life incidents involving women who followed their male family members onto Revolutionary War battlefields. Now known as, quote, "camp followers," end quote, these women were essential to the success of the war. Camp followers cared for men of all social ranks, acting as laundresses, cooks, water bearers, seamstresses, nurses, and critical supply links. They were so omnipresent that they were often paid by regimental leaders and disciplined for bad behavior in camp. In her book, Belonging to the Army, Camp Followers and Community During the American Revolution, historian Holly A. Mayer estimates that there were between 3,500 and 7,000 such camp followers during the American Revolution, about one for every 30 or 35 soldiers. though sometimes accused of loose morals or prostitution, and rarely compensated for their service. Camp followers nonetheless played an important role in the revolution. The figure of Molly Pitcher became common as an American's told, retold, and embellished battlefield stories in the wake of the revolution. And Butterfield found the first known recorded Molly Pitcher stories in newspapers and encyclopedias dating from the 1830s. In one widely circulated example from 1830, a woman known as, quote, Captain Molly, end quote, makes a dramatic speech about avenging her husband's death before taking his place at the cannon. After the battle, she is thanked by George Washington himself. Though early versions of the tale emphasize Molly's nerve and her more masculine exploit during battle, Butterfield notes that later versions focused on her patriotism and loyalty to her husband, reinforcing social expectations about acceptable femininity. Though the specific inspiration for the Molly Pitcher figure may be contested, the tall tale points to historical reality, the presence and participation of women on every battlefield of the Revolutionary War. Though women were barred from military service, they simply showed up alongside their husbands, brothers, and fathers. These camp followers became common subjects of battlefield lore, many of which could have inspired at least part of the Molly Pitcher legend. One of them, Mary Ludwig Hayes, is the figure most commonly identified with the Molly Pitcher tale. The daughter of German-born immigrants, she married barber John Hayes in 1769. When the Revolutionary War began, John joined a Pennsylvania artillery regiment, and his wife followed him throughout multiple battles. At the Battle of Monmouth, on June 28, 1778, the Continental Army faced the British amid sweltering summer conditions. One participant, Private Joseph Plum Martin, recalled in a later memoir that he watched a woman assisting her husband at his gun throughout the battle. Quote, while in the act of reaching for a cartridge and having one of her feet as far before the other as she could step, a cannon shot from the enemy passed directly between her legs without doing any other damage than carrying away all the lower part of her petticoat, end quote. Martin wrote, quote, looking at it with apparent unconcern, she observed it was lucky it did not pass a little higher, for in that case it might have carried away something else, and continued her occupation, end quote. Though Martin did not identify the nonchalant gunner by name, modern historians think Hayes, whose husband served in the same regiment, may be the unnamed woman whose petticoat was shot off. Intriguingly, Hayes, by then widowed and remarried, was eventually awarded an annual pension for her wartime service by Pennsylvania lawmakers. At some point in the mid-19th century, Hayes' name began appearing in stories of the legendary Molly Pitcher. Other real-life Mollies applied for pensions for their wartime service, and many have helped their fallen husbands during battle. Another example is Margaret Corbin, a camp follower who helped defend Fort Washington from Hessian troops early in the Revolutionary War. Corbin had accompanied her husband, Virginia farmer John Corbin, to battle and reportedly took his place at his cannon when he was injured during the Battle of Fort Washington. Despite sustaining multiple life-threatening injuries herself, she remained on the battlefield until her unit surrendered to the British. Released by her British captors soon after the battle, her story soon reached government officials, who arranged for a pension equivalent to half of a male soldier's monthly pay. Massachusetts' Deborah Sampson was also nicknamed Molly by her fellow soldiers for her feminine appearance. Sampson defied the Continental Army's gender line by posing as a man and enlisting in the war while wearing men's clothing. She was ultimately discharged from the Continental Army after sustaining wounds in multiple battles. After the war, Sampson toured the new country giving lectures about her wartime experiences. But her service was only honored after her death, when her husband, Benjamin Gannett, petitioned Congress for a spouse's pension. Forgotten Stories, Real Heroes. Why has one fictitious woman come to stand in for so many real-life heroines? Historian Stephanie Hall offers one possible explanation. Camp followers defied gender norms, leaving hearth and home to accompany men into the grime and misery of war. Once the war ended, women's often gender-bending wartime exploits were downplayed, a pattern that occurred after other American conflicts, such as the Civil War and both World Wars. Women in a civil defense unit in drill practice, Newark, New Jersey, in 1940. Molly Pitcher Brigade was a grassroots women's civil defense organization formed a year before the U.S. entered World War II. The group was established to train women in basic military. As Revolutionary War legends took root in the years after the war, Hall writes, many women who served in the war were overlooked or remained silent about their own service. To Butterfield, Molly Pitcher is a, quote, comforting example of dramatic but quickly contained feminine female patriotism, end quote. A patriotism that drove women to abandon their traditional sphere to assist in birthing a new nation. Perhaps the most convincing evidence of a real-life Molly Pitcher is the existence of the legend itself. Though still undersung, the brave women of the American Revolution persist in the stories they inspired, even if the specifics of their service are lost to time. The end. This is Paul, and I'll be reading an article from the National Geographic magazine entitled, A River Crisis is Unfolding in the American West, by Luke Runyon. Water levels were so low on the Colorado River, Travis Francis knew he needed to shock some fish. On a recent June morning, Francis, a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist, stepped onto an inflatable raft at Riverbend Park in Palisade, the hub of Colorado's stone fruit orchards. The day was warm and sunny, the cottonwoods along the river nearly ready to drop their seasonal fuzz. A crew from the Upper Colorado River Endangered Fish Recovery Program, including Francis, pushed away from the bank, carrying nets, buckets, and tracking tag readers to examine and record any endangered fish they came across. Today's task was electrofishing. A minor electrical current temporarily stuns the fish so the native ones can be collected, cataloged, and returned to the river unharmed. An anode the size of a disco ball hangs in the water ahead of the raft and a crew member with a net quickly snags the stunned fish as they rise to the surface. Any sighting would be hopeful and foreboding. The fish have so far survived a mounting crisis, but Francis knows soon the fish in this river reach might not have any water left to swim in. Quote, "Everything is just so very different this year," end quote, Francis says. Back in April, residents of Colorado's Grand Valley witnessed an unsettling sight, and one that many have not seen before, a nearly dry Colorado River. Levels were so low on the river, which sustains 40 million people, along with 5 million acres of farmland and the Southwest's wildlife, they generated algae blooms and set off low water alarms in utility office. The time made it even more distressing. Late April is when the snow starts to melt and the rivers rise. Seeing it drop to near record low so early left many to wonder, what, if any, water will be left by August? The Colorado River has been struggling for more than two decades now as warming temperatures have ramped up across the Southwest. Dwindling snowpack and steady use has widened an existing gap between water supply and demand. But 2026 is putting the river into uncharted territory. Snow, which gathers high in the Rocky Mountains and then melts to form the Colorado and its many tributaries, totaled half its normal amount this past winter, and subsequent stream flows are among the lowest on record. What's more, the scant snowpack melted rapidly, and months early, during a March heat wave, that pushed temperatures into the 80s across Colorado's western slope. The consequences cascaded quickly. As snow disappeared from the mountains, dark ground absorbed more heat. Plants began consuming moisture earlier. Streams that normally received a gradual pulse of snowmelt instead surged and faded almost immediately. Farmers turned on irrigation systems weeks ahead of schedule. Crucial high mountain reservoirs failed to fill. The literal downstream effects are evident throughout the Colorado River Basin. Reservoirs Meade and Powell, the nation's two largest, are approaching levels that would have seemed unimaginable just a generation ago. Now there is not enough water flowing to meet the needs of the seven U.S. states and two Mexican states that rely on the river. Increased demand for water and meager supplies meant very little leftover water for the fish, four species of which are endangered or threatened: the razorback sucker, Colorado pike minnow, humpback chub, and bony tail. Conditions on the river have the potential to unseat 2002 as the worst ever recorded. Quote, "The March melt-off we had, there's no comparison to 2002, end quote, says Brad Udall, a water and climate research scientist at Colorado State University. Quote, "It's far worse. We lost 60% of our snowpack 4 weeks earlier than normal," end quote, which means communities are already being forced to cut back, and the fish species could be pushed to the brink. Western Colorado farmers who grow peaches, wine grapes, cherries, and alfalfa hay use most of the river's water in the Grand Valley. They have tried to keep this reach wet for decades to avoid costly endangered species regulations, realizing their fates are intimately tied to the health of the native fish that swim in the turbid water. But when water is scarce, the relationship among the water users in this arid valley put to the test. Quote, when push comes to shove, are we going to put environmental uses above the survival of the communities here, end quote, says Bruce Talbot, a multi-generation peach grower in Palisade. Quote, I struggle with that, end quote. Into the reach. One distinct stretch of the Colorado River in the Grand Valley has become a microcosm of the persistent issues that dominate Western water discussions. Known as the 15-mile reach, this section of the Colorado is a place where agricultural use, municipal demand, and needs for recreation and wildlife converge. As it enters the valley, the river snakes past steep sandstone cliffs and through hilly slopes lined with peach orchards. Just outside Palisade, Colorado, much of the water leaves the riverbed and enters a Rube Goldberg-style plumbing network of canals that feed vineyards and hay fields throughout the Grand Valley. 15 miles downstream, the reach ends where the Gunnison River joins the Colorado in the city of Grand Junction, beyond which the landscape begins to transition into the Red Rock Canyons of the Colorado-Utah border. In an average year, the river continues flowing through the reach, albeit reduced from the demands to grow crops and keep suburban lawns green. During exceptionally dry years like this one, however, nearly every available drop can be diverted upstream, sent into the sprawling plumbing system. This year, the reach briefly dropped to roughly 55 cubic feet per second. For comparison, that is less water than many small mountain creeks carry during a typical summer, which is why Francis, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist with the Upper Colorado River Endangered Fish Recovery Program, knew they needed to get on the river to electro-stun some fish. Founded in the 1980s, the recovery program brings together water users with federal officials to head off tensions that may arise while enforcing the Endangered Species Act. Today, its partners include state and federal agencies, irrigation districts, tribes, environmental organizations, and hydropower interests. Its core funding comes from hydropower revenues generated at the Colorado River's dams, plus federal funds appropriated by Congress. Francis has spent 23 years working on recovering these fish. They are not delicate creatures, he says. Fossil evidence shows the fish date back 3 to 5 million years, meaning they survived the last time the Southwest was a subtropical climate and through the last ice age in North America. Long before dams, reservoirs, and diversion canals, the Colorado River was a wildly dynamic place. Spring snowmelt transformed the river into a muddy torrent that routinely jumped its banks. Water temperatures swung dramatically. Entire channels shifted position. In the Grand Valley, where the river widens and slows, cobbled bottoms and backwaters along its main channel became havens for the fish during their seasonal spawns. The Colorado pike minnow, once capable of growing nearly 6 feet long, evolved to navigate hundreds of miles through the river and its tributaries, swallowing smaller fish whole in its gaping mouth. Razorback suckers developed their distinctive humpback silhouette while adapting to powerful currents and shifting river bottoms. And while they get plenty of attention from scientists, there are still unknowns. Francis says, like why so many of the Colorado's native fish have flashy gold scales scattered around their bodies. Quote, this river was everything from drought-stricken to raging, torrent floods, just very hard conditions on the species that are here, end quote, Francis says. Quote, they've evolved with that, end quote. What they did not evolve for was a river that disappears. After a morning of electrofishing downstream of Palisade, the crew finds just two razorback suckers, fewer than expected. No pike minnows or bony tails. They pull out a bucket full of invasive smallmouth bass, green sunfish, and white sucker. Despite the low catch rate, Francis is hopeful. Quote, I think a lot of our fish kind of got the cue to leave the stretch, which is a good thing, and go to where there's more water, end quote, he says of the April low-flow event. The fish may have escaped this time. But Francis worries about what could happen later this summer, when a full dry-up of the 15-mile reach is a real possibility. Quote, so you dry up a riverbed, end quote, he says. Quote, it's going to be a biological desert for everything, not just our fish, end quote. The fish have become a living proxy of the Colorado River's health. When they struggle, it often means the river itself is struggling. And in 2026, nearly every indicator is flashing red. An uneasy balance. For nearly four decades, the recovery program has attempted something that once seemed impossible. Recover endangered native fish while still allowing people to develop and use the Colorado River. The arrangement has largely worked, creating a complicated yet mutually beneficial relationship. Farmers can complete small on-farm water projects without going through costly permitting. Fish biologists gain funding and new partnerships to rebuild populations. Reservoir operators release water timed to spawning seasons. Crews remove invasive predators with nets. Hatcheries raise young fish and release them into the river. One fish, the humpback chub, has already been downlisted from endangered to threatened. The razorback sucker could be next. Water providers help support recovery efforts by leasing water for environmental flows or by participating in conservation programs to make their rickety infrastructure more efficient. In 2021, recovery program funded helped construct a new hydropower plant near Palisade that replaced a 90-year-old facility. Fish managers worked with water users to provide regulatory certainty. Both recognized that prolonged conflicts benefits nobody and would likely lead to worse outcomes for the fish. Still, the unprecedented conditions in 2026 are exposing limits and testing the relationships, which can be put under strain when the choice is to keep either the river or the canals wet. Quote, we are concerned about endangered species compliance. We are concerned about the fish and the environment and our recreational economy, end quote, says Tina Berganzini, general manager of the Grand Valley Water Users Association, which oversees one of the valley's largest canal projects. Quote, but we're also really concerned about agriculture being our number one economy in the Grand Valley, end quote. Berganzini represents irrigators whose livelihoods depend on moving water from the river to fields and orchards. Her members are already bracing for a potentially dry canal before the growing season is done this fall, meaning fallowed fields and lost revenue. That would be a first in her canal's 112-year history. She also spends time coordinating with fish managers and state agencies trying to maintain habitat in the 15-mile reach. Quote, nobody wants to see the reach dried up, end quote, she says. Quote, from an optics standpoint, of course, farmers don't want to constantly be labeled the bad guy because they're trying to grow food. But on the other hand, it is also their home, and nobody wants to see a dry river. End quote. The hardest months are ahead. At Talbot's Mountain Gold, rows of peach trees stretch toward the towering sandstone Book Cliffs. The Talbot family has farmed here for generations. Their orchards help produce roughly a quarter of Colorado's annual peach crop. Quote, "We live and die by snowpack," end quote, says orchardist Bruce Talbot. Quote, "We didn't get any this year," end quote. Talbot remembers the drought of 1977 and irrigation water spitting up dust as it entered his family's parched orchards. Even then, he says, the canal still carried water. This year feels different. For more than a century, fruit growers planted trees with the assumption that the Colorado River in the Grand Valley would remain dependable. Orchard investments are measured not in seasons, but in decades. Quote, "We wouldn't plant trees here if we thought we would ever run out of water," end quote, Talbot says. He is preparing for his irrigation water to potentially be shut off before the end of this growing season. Some of his trees could die, and others will need to be irrigated with water hauled in by trucks until they go dormant. The hardest months still lie ahead. For Francis, August is the month that keeps him awake at night. By then, water temperatures will peak. River flows will likely be at their lowest. Conditions favorable to invasive smallmouth bass, one of the most effective predators of native fishes, will expand as water temperatures rise and flows retreat. Yet even as conditions deteriorate, conservationists continue adapting. At a constructed wetland in Grand Junction, managers hoped spring runoff would connect habitat naturally to the river this year. Instead, low flows forced them to improvise. Water from a canal was routed into the wetland. 5,000 larval bony tail were transported from a hatchery and stocked by hand. Quote, "It's that adaptive management," end quote, Francis says. The phrase is bureaucratic. In practice, it means responding to emergencies that previously generations never anticipated. As the Colorado River Basin, across the Colorado River Basin, similar emergency adaptations are becoming routine. This year alone, many of the agricultural districts in the Grand Valley have volunteered to forego some of their water, so some smaller upstream uses are not fully cut off. The challenge, according to Udall, is that climate change continues moving faster than our infrastructure and the many institutions that manage it were designed to handle. The word aridification has become common among Western water experts. It describes something more permanent than drought, a long-term drying trend driven by rising temperatures that changes how much water ultimately reaches rivers. What is happening in 2026 offers a preview of that future. Quote, "This long-term trend is pointing us to a fundamental changes and how ecosystems and economies will work in the 21st century," end quote, Udall says. For now, these changes remain concentrated in places like the 15-mile reach, where competing demands collide in a shrinking river channel. As summer heat begins to settle over the Grand Valley, Francis returns his attention to the fish and their resilience. They are long-lived species. An electrofishing crew recovered a 40-year-old razorback sucker from the reach this past spring. Their recovery has always been measured in generations rather than years. Quote, "I'm hoping that even though this is a tough year," end quote, he says, quote, that we can still be doing the things we need to do in order to recover these fishes. End quote. The end. This is Paul, and I'll be reading an article from the National Geographic magazine entitled, "The Ancient Maya May Have Had Sophisticated Dentists," by Joshua Rapp Learn. Centuries before the advent of Novocaine, electric drills, and x-rays, the ancient Maya may have been closing tooth cavities with jade inlays. Teeth decorated with jade, quote, fool's gold, end quote, and other materials have turned up at Maya archaeological sites for decades. The Maya carved small holes in teeth and sealed the stones in place, and that the decoration served some sort of aesthetic purpose. A new analysis of a molar with a jade inlay reveals some of the strongest evidence yet. The Maya didn't just fix their teeth with ornamental, quote, grills, end quote, for fashion or ritual. They may have also done it to relieve aches or pains. Quote, it's so perfect, the cavity, end quote, says Elma Vega Lizama, a dental anthropologist at the Autonomous University of the Yucatan in Mexico and co-author of the new study. Quote, it's really a good procedure. Well done. Clean. End quote. This precise placement is part of the team's argument published in the Journal of Archaeological Science reports that the Maya were defter at dentistry than previously suspected. Were jade teeth just for show? The tooth comes from one of the largest collections of Maya teeth in the world at the Popol Vuh Museum at the Francisco Marroquin University in Guatemala City. The molar was given as a gift to the study's first author, Estuardo Mata Castillo, a dentist at the Francisco Marroquin University in Guatemala. Prior to that, its origins are unclear. The authors believe it came from somewhere near Guatemala City, likely the ruins of Camilajugu, a Maya city inhabited from about 1500 BC to 900 AD, that lies mostly underneath the modern-day metropolis. A molar from a massive collection of teeth at the Popol Vuh Museum at the Francisco Marroquin University in Guatemala City in Guatemala is the only tooth of its kind with jade inlay. Acquiring a sample from the tooth for molecular testing would have damaged it, but the authors believe it dates to the classic period, from AD 250 to 900, when Camilajugu was at the peak of its regional power. Most teeth that contain these decorations come from this, quote, golden age, end quote. In all cases, it's difficult to say why the Maya modified their teeth. But the fact that most inlays appear in the more visible front teeth has led many researchers to link the alterations to ritual, fashion, or perhaps even a mixture of both. Status could also have played a role. Researchers have found inlays in classic-era Maya teeth from the rich and poor, but they are certainly more common in higher-status individuals, notes Marcos Ramirez Salomon, an orthodontist at the Autonomous University of the Yucatan and author on the paper. Some high-status people had as many as 8 inlays in their mouth of various shapes and colors. Quote, they are more opulent, end quote, he says. Clues in the glue. Most inlays are made of jade, but some are made of a mineral pyrite commonly called, quote, fool's gold, end quote. Other teeth lack stones and are instead just filled with a black cement normally used to hold the stones in place. The cement ingredients have suggested something beyond aesthetics and opulence might be at play in the Maya dental practices. In a previous analysis, Ramirez Salomon, Vega Lizama, and their colleagues found traces of phosphates, calcium, vegetable oils from flowers and such, and sometimes bitumen in their sealants. Some of these sealants are better than those used in modern dental fillings, Ramirez Salomon says. He points to the fact that modern fillings sometimes fall out within the lifetimes of people who have cavities. While these inlays have stood the test of time, lasting centuries or even more than a millennium after the individual died. The sealants also likely carried antiseptic properties, Ramirez Salomon says. The team has found less evidence of secondary cavity damage around these inlays, and less evidence of cavities in general in the teeth of people with inlays compared to the teeth of classic Maya without inlays. Why modify a tooth you can't see? All of the gem-encrusted Maya teeth uncovered so far are front teeth. But this new inlay is unique in that it is only a modified molar, yet known by researchers, says Ramirez Salomon. The location of the back tooth gives more weight to the case that it wasn't purely the fashion or status, especially due to its lack of visibility, says Roger Forshaw, a researcher who studies ancient Egyptian dentistry at the University of Manchester in the United Kingdom, who was not involved in this recent paper. Quote, "Nevertheless, the absence of visibility does not necessarily exclude symbolic or ritual significance," end quote, he says. Quote, "Objects that are not readily visible to others may still carry personal, social, or religious meaning for the individual concerned," end quote. Forshaw says the theory that the molar inlay was for health or pain relief is, quote, "plausible," end quote, but not a demonstrated fact. The unusual specimen, quote, "raises the possibility that some Maya dental interventions may have extended beyond the decorative modifications for which they are best known," end quote, he says. Maya dental precision. The ancient expert who placed the jade in the molar did it while the patient was alive, Vega Lizama says. Using 3D tomography imagery, the research team peeked inside the tooth, and the inlay shows signs of calcifying after placement. Quote, "The authors make a persuasive case that the inlay was inserted during life, based on the evidence of pulp calcification," end quote, says Forshaw. Due to the development of the tooth, Vega Lizama and her colleagues suspect that the individual was likely a late teenager and lived for 5 to 10 years after the procedure. Further analysis using an electron microscope revealed the degree of precision that the Maya dentist used. The molar has rounded marks demonstrating the use of some kind of rudimentary drill. Ramirez Salomon still isn't sure how the Maya did these operations. Archaeologists have never found such a tool in digs, though given how fine it would have been, this isn't really a surprise. The exactness of many inlays also suggests a jeweler's intricate level of skill. Quote, "Some of these inlays are so precise that when you put it in a tooth, you can hear a click when you put it inside," end quote, he says. At the end of the day, this tooth was one of a kind and of uncertain provenance, as both authors of the study and Forshaw point out. Quote, "As such, it raises interesting questions, but does not by itself justify broad conclusions about Maya dental practice," end quote, Forshaw says. But it nonetheless introduces the possibility that ancient Maya had someone to turn to keep the tooth fairy a little at bay. The end. This is Paul, and I'll be reading an article from the National Geographic magazine entitled, "Vesuvius Buried These Scrolls. AI is Bringing Them Back," by Sam Keen. Imagine inheriting the finest bottle of wine ever made, a rare vintage unlike anything else in the world. Now imagine the bottle is so delicate that even touching the cork would shatter it. It's there in front of you, a priceless treasure, but, quote, "you can't drink it," end quote, muses Giorgio Angelotti. That's the maddening predicament Angelotti and generations of other scholars have endured trying to decipher the Herculean scrolls. The AD 79 eruption of Mount Vesuvius that ravaged Pompeii also buried the nearby town of Herculean, entombing its celebrated library at the Villa of Papyri under 60 feet of ash and rock. Hundreds of papyrus scrolls survived the inferno thanks to that very heavy blanket of volcanic debris. Instead of burning, they baked into brittle, misshapen lumps, preserved yet so fragile that archaeologists feared touching them. The Villa of the Papyri collection is only known library to survive from Greco-Roman antiquity. Still, its prized texts have long been impossible to read. Even the slightest brush can turn them to dust. Now, nearly 2,000 years after Vesuvian tragedy, the scrolls are giving up their secrets at last. Using particle accelerators and artificial intelligence, researchers finally have the ability to virtually, quote, unwrap, end quote, the Herculean scrolls and read their contents. Led by Piperologist Federica Nicolardi and a team of other historians, scientists, and AI experts like Angelotti, the discoveries are being unveiled in National Geographic. They have identified one scroll as potentially among the oldest in Roman history, while another could provide great insights into Greek theology and the legendary gods of Olympus. Sometimes Nicolardi has to stop and remind herself how profound it is to be able to read these sealed-off texts after centuries of frustration and false hope. Quote, "This is history," end quote, she says, as she prepares to help present the findings at a conference in Naples, Italy. Quote, "This is completely changing the discipline," end quote. Despite the fragility of the scrolls, the temptation to try to unfurl them has, time and again, proved irresistible. Ever since the Villa of the Papyri was unearthed in 1750, archaeologists have contrived all sorts of methods to force the scrolls open, from injecting them with mercury to painting them with ether or papyrus sap to soften them. Early attempts did yield some results, including the revelation that the collection consisted mostly of Greek-language works by Philodemus, a 1st century B.C. philosopher and adherent of Epicureanism, a school of thought that emphasizes avoiding fear and pain in order to ensure pleasure. Beyond that, the gleanings were meager, and the unwrapping methods often destroyed the priceless papyrus. On a recent visit to the Biblioteca Nazionale di Napoli, Vittorio Emanuele III, a national library in Naples, where most of the scrolls are stored, Nicolardi's team pulled out a tray of them, compact and blackened, lying atop a bed of cotton dusted with ashy flakes, a reminder of how easily they fall apart. Angelotti once accidentally got some specks of ash on his fingers. Instead of brushing them into the trash, he dabbed a few on his tongue. They tasted like burnt wood, an echo, perhaps, of that hellish day in A.D. 79. Especially exciting is the smallest scroll on the tray, which Nicolati and company believe could shed some light on the emergence of a major school of philosophical thought. In the 1980s, scholars attempted to open it by using a mixture of gelatin and acetic acid, hoping to soften the scroll so the small bits could be peeled off. While they glimpsed a few scattered letters, more than half the scroll was destroyed in the process. Today, all that remains intact is the bottom half of the scroll's final section, which Angelotti and other AI experts have now successfully extracted. A detailed interpretation of the work is tricky. Imagine analyzing a book when you can read only the bottom few lines of its final pages. Yet what has emerged so far is striking. The author reflects on whether human beings can be morally perfect and how to distinguish good from evil. The writer then contrasts, quote, mechanical arts, end quote, such as blacksmithing and woodworking, with, quote, theoretical arts, end quote, like geometry, exploring, as Nicolati puts it, quote, how arts can help people in general, or how wise men should devote themselves to arts, end quote. The text also touches on epistemology, probing the foundations and limits of knowledge. Quote, we will inquire into something, end quote, the author writes. Quote, but we will not understand it if in some way we depart from ourselves and from our own nature, end quote. The scroll's themes align closely with the philosophical school of Stoicism, which prioritizes reason and virtue in pursuit of a good life. The presence of a Stoic text in a library devoted mostly to Epicurean works is not totally surprising. Quote, Stoics and Epicureans were rival schools, but debates and polemics between them were common, end quote, Nicolati explains. It's possible that the author was an Epicurean engaged in an ideological debate, firing salvos in an ancient culture war. The author's mention of a nephew and a disciple of the Greek philosopher Chrysippus, who was a primary influence on early Stoicism, could help illuminate the origins of that school and its rivalry with Epicureanism. Perhaps even more compelling is what the writing reveals about the scroll's age. Nicolati noticed that the author's handwriting appears more archaic than the writing on other scrolls, with letters more angular and varied in shape. Based on this, she dates the papyrus to the 2nd or possibly 3rd century B.C., making it at least a century older than Philodemus's works in the collection, and thus among the oldest scrolls ever found from Roman times. Given the scroll's fragmentary nature, determining their titles is a considerable challenge. But Nicolati and her team have confirmed another one. Quote, O Gods, Book 8, end quote, by Philodemus. They have not yet studied this text in full, but they have teased out some terms one might expect in a work of theology, like, quote, providence, end quote, and, quote, invisible entities, end quote. Other phrases are head scratches, like this one alluding to broken pottery. Quote, that the intellective principle is in the whole in the same way as rather than in potsherds. Potsherds, end quote. Most important is the, quote, is the number, quote, 8, end quote, in the title. Previously, scholars knew of only books 1 and possibly 3 in the, quote, O Gods, end quote, series, which explores the nature of the Greek gods. The discovery of Book 8 therefore seems to prove the existence of several unknown works, any one of which could turn up in the Herculean collection and further our knowledge on the pantheon of Greek gods. This interpretive work is possible only because of technological advances. Since the early 2000s, University of Kentucky computer vision specialist Brent Seals has been developing a process to virtually unwrap the scrolls. His method involves capturing 3D images of their internal layers using X-ray tomography, like a hospital CT scan, which software then segments into patches and flattens for optimal reading. After an early attempt to reach the images failed, Seal's team rescanned some scrolls with a massive particle accelerator called a synchrotron for higher resolution. Originally at 8 microns and later down to 2 microns, dozens of times smaller than the width of a human hair. They have had other ideas to improve the images since then. In certain scanning technologies, software can trace the complicated twists of neurons through biological tissues. Seals similarly trace papyrus fibers through the scrolls to help segmentation. He also developed an AI, quote, ink hound, end quote, to automatically detect the texture of ink, which often looks like dried mud on scans and helps render the scrolls readable. Unfortunately, his team lacked the time and resources to adapt this kind of software, not to mention that training AI requires gargantuan amounts of data. So in 2023, Seals released all his team's images and code publicly and teamed up with two Silicon Valley financiers to create the Vesuvius Challenge, which has awarded more than $1.8 million in prizes for help building ink detection algorithms, and ultimately unlocking the mysteries of the Herculean scrolls. Some 27 scrolls are now being studied, but the procedure remains time-consuming. Specialists like Angelotti have to tweak the AI parameters for each individual scroll to produce the clearest possible image, a process that Seals likens to Hollywood special effects wizards fussing over scenes frame by frame. Dozens of scrolls have been imaged, but the work has only just begun. The digitization process is still ongoing. The technology is improving, and beneath Herculean, there may be even more buried scrolls. When Seals began his work, it sometimes took years between an initial scan and the recovery of readable text. Quote, but we believe that ultimately, with automated results, time to text will be 90% correct within a 24-hour period, end quote, he says. Seals also sees a day when the technology can be used to read damaged works from other sites, like the Dead Sea Scrolls. Meanwhile, more scrolls could be buried at Herculean, which has never been fully excavated. Nicolati, for one, is eager to take advantage of this marriage between traditional papyrology and new high-tech methods to unlock more ancient secrets. Quote, this evolution is happening to a discipline that was kind of ready for it. End quote. The end.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
What's your vision?
People with disabilities adapt on a daily basis. They're people you want on your team. And we're here to help you find blind and visually impaired professionals to help you reach your organizational goals. Building an inclusive workforce where individuals with disabilities are welcome is possible thanks to Mass Commission for the Blind. Partner with them to hire individuals who are blind or visually impaired and reach your workforce goals. The success of your organization depends on the diversity of your team. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB to learn how you can become an employer partner for the blindness community. That's 1-800-392-6450. or mass.gov/MCB.
What's your vision?